about the militarization of our police force just right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the inaugural Montevilla Jazz Festival at Post 5 Theater, August 16th and 17th. This two-day music festival focuses entirely on the new sound of Portland jazz. It features a diverse lineup of 13 cutting-edge, adventurous, Portland-based jazz acts performing only original music. Performers include the Blue Cranes, Tim Wilcox Super Jazzers, the Optic Nerve Trio, and more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival at Post 5 Theater, 850 Northeast 81st Avenue in Portland, Saturday, August 16th and Sunday, August 17th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River on Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab, 6543 North Burlington in North Portland. This storytelling event will feature the Grand Ronde Tribe's history of the river, as well as drumming by tribal members. Raconteur Roger Wendlick will offer a description of Lewis and Clark's first impressions of the Lower Willamette, and Sean Morgan will describe experiences living aboard a sailboat at Willamette Cove. The Willamette River Superfund Community Advisory will be on hand to offer updates, information, and opportunities for community feedback. Again, that's The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. يوم تدي ويوم تاخد منك وحاجات تحسبها وما تطولهاش وحاجات تيجي لغاية عندك دي قصة تعيش غريب اصبر مش عيب مكتوب الرزق ساحب سحبه فكرنا دايما والله ما دايما الحد ولا هي باقية له ولا حد يبقى الحد فكرنا دايما
Okay. Yes, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is Positively Revolting. This is Joe Uris. I'm sitting in as host for the excellent feminist show. And I'm going to talk about some serious things that have been happening lately. First of all, murder in Missouri. After looking around the Ferguson event, after listening to the various witnesses, there are now three witnesses to the actual murder. It is obvious that a police officer in Ferguson, for no apparent reason, shot an unarmed man, an 18-year-old man who the next day would have been going to college. Now, that last part is pretty irrelevant, but it is typical of the kind of waste of life that we see, the disrespect for life that we're beginning to see more and more in policing in the United States. I want to follow two things here, two threads. First, and they're both related, the treatment of minorities and minority communities by the police. And I'm going to use some examples from Portland history as well as national history. And then the other part of this relationship is the increasing militarization of the police in the United States. And this is something I have seen go on for years and years and years. It is characteristic of the police in the United States that they've always been the support agents, often the instrument of violence against organized labor, against groups of young people, against the anti-war movement, and so on. And I might add, in the history of the civil rights struggle, against African Americans and others in their efforts to gain civil liberties and civil rights. So let's get started here. This is kind of sad stuff. And it's really also something that we all need to realize from our own history. I will use examples not just from the national perspective, but also from the local perspective, from my own experience and from the experiences of others. I would welcome your calls on this topic, on these two topics, really, 231-8187. And this is an amazing, this thing in Ferguson was so out front, obvious, weird, and ugly, and violent, and militarized, that it was pretty amazing. It wasn't subtle. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't secretive. It was out there, and it was violent, and it was absolutely unnecessary. Let's talk a little bit about some police behavior. If you look at 1963, those of you who are old enough to remember 1963, you have the images of the police supporting the segregationist governments in the South, in Birmingham and other places, using dogs, fire hoses, arrests, whippings to control African American communities. This was police behavior. Police behavior. So in the civil rights struggle, it became quite obvious that the police were, as many of us have always said, just simply the instrument of the ruling class. In more recent times, in the times that all of you will remember, I'm going to go back to 1970 in Portland. The first instance which was really clear of the militarization of the Portland police was under the leadership of a guy named Brulé, real name Brulette, who was a lieutenant who created the Top Squad, which was essentially a tactical riot squad. They had long white batons. They had special helmets. They didn't in those days have armor yet, but their job was to essentially disperse crowds by cracking heads. And they did that in 1970 in May at Portland State University without any real provocation. And that was an event that got a lot of publicity, but it was just the beginning of something that would continue on and on and on. I want to talk briefly in that context about what I saw as a reporter for the Oregonian in 99. In 1999, there was a May Day celebration. It was one of those kind of Portland things. They were the Maypole people. They were the pagans. There were the anti-war folks. There were the civil rights folks. There were the many, many communities had gathered together, and without a permit, but with permission, clear permission, they were in the streets. They marched from the South Park blocks through various parts of town. At some point, a rumor went through the police lines that a window at the Nike store had been broken. Turns out not to have been true. The police, many on horses, well, whatever horses they had, suddenly turned on the crowd. I saw a woman with a baby carriage having the carriage. Now, the carriage had water in it, not a baby, as I recall, being knocked over by a horse. And I watched as the police had their uniforms changed. In front of my eyes, the people on horses exchanged their cowboy hats for helmets. All this happened up and down the line. The police suddenly became a militarized unit, and they began to force the crowd to the riverfront. At one point, they had surrounded the people so that there were police on three sides, the river at the back of the crowd, and the police began to attack. They fired less than lethal weapons. They didn't use tear gas. And they battered that crowd incredibly. And I was there. I was in a suit and tie. And I, at one point, realized that I was in a dangerous position. And being a coward, ultimately, I fled to what was then a bar called McCall's, which is now the Rose Festival Center. And at the door of the bar, there was a bouncer. He said, "Hey, you can't come in here." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm a reporter and I want to get a drink." And he said, "Oh, come on in." So I did. I bought myself a drink and then I left. And then I walked back toward the park blocks. And I saw, as I arrived near the art museum, several police officers tackle and take down and beat a young man who was running from the police. I never found out why he was running or why they were beating him. This was recorded by a camera crew in a helicopter and later was played on the news. Then the crowd marched its original route back to its original route to go to Powell's Books, which at that time was engaged in a labor struggle that has since, by the way, been resolved. And this was at the same time that the Longshoremen's Union was having its national meetings at the Hilton Hotel. And the police had been pretty much beating on the crowd. I saw the radical cheerleaders in tears. I saw many people with bruises and with hurt. And at that time, I was wondering what was going on. As the police decided to end the demonstration, the longshoremen heard about what was going on. And you have to understand that the Powell's staff had been unionized by the Longshoremen's Union. So down the street from the Hilton Hotel toward Powell's bookstore came the longshoremen. Now these are the older members, more often than not, of the Longshoremen's Union. These are people, men and women, who are big, who are strong, who are perhaps some of them as broad as they are high. And they were not children. They were not, you couldn't throw them around. And while I was standing there, the head of the Longshoremen's Union came up to the police, to a police person, I think it was a sergeant, and said, "Well, we have a permit. We're going to cross the street here." That was Burnside. "And we're going to picket and we're going to have a rally." And he said, "No, it's all been canceled." And the head of the Longshoremen's Union said, "You can't cancel. We're the Longshoremen's Union. You know, then come on." And the officer, to my amazement, took his large club and whacked the head of the union right on the thigh. Now, if you or I had been hit by a club on the thigh, you would have been kind of out of it. You probably would have been down on your down. You probably would have down, been down on your knees. But the head of the Longshoremen's Union said, "What the?" And I can't use the word. "Are you doing? I want to talk to your commanding officer." And then the attitude began to change, and suddenly the police parted, and the longshoremen and the whole crowd had their rally. Now, I had been hired by the Oregonian to write a story about how it was a sort of a family fight there at Powell's. The story's tenor changed. I was later invited by the mayor to come in and talk about what I saw. And I made clear that the police were the instigators of that riot. Now, from the time of 1970 to the time of 1999 when that happened, I saw the police become more and more militarized. I date the militarization really from 1968 when the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, created by President Nixon, had instigated more and more militarization of the police, providing tear gas, providing less than lethal weaponry, providing armor. And I've watched the police over the years change from people, from the community to faceless, masked, armored personnel who you could no longer talk with, who you could not reason with, who you could not exchange words with except in a hostile context. And the culmination of that really was during the Occupy movement here in Portland and across the nation, where suddenly the police were an occupying army. They were armored, they were heavily weaponed, they were dangerous. That pattern was, from my point of view, odd. Odd in one way, that is, that why, since there was no real physical danger, but odd in another way. What was the politics behind it? Well, now we know. The military, after 9/11, the military began to provide surplus equipment to the police So we have up-armored vehicles. We have incredible sniper rifles. We have weapons of incredible dimension in the hands of the police. And in Ferguson, when young people were angry and in the streets, just the other day, we saw the consequence of that. We saw armored personnel carriers on the top of which were police with sniper rifles, the rifles aimed into the crowd. This is the reality of the situation in that context. So there are two issues here. The first issue, perhaps the most important from the point of view of human rights and human liberties, is the fact that the police in New York, the police in Los Angeles, the police in Ferguson are murdering young black men. And I'm not backing off from that description. Murdering young black men. This pattern of murder is a racist, virtually genocidal pattern. And I'm afraid it's going to get worse before it gets better. I do not see adequate change, adequate understanding, adequate effort toward what used to be called community policing. That's number one. Number two, beginning with the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, and certainly after 9/11, the police have been up-armored, as they say in the trade. That means they wear armor. They have helmets that include a face shield. You no longer can have a peaceful, reasonable discourse with a police officer in the context of an action on the streets. There's no way. And the police are frightened of the demonstrators, and the demonstrators are very reasonably terrified of the police. I saw an instance during the Occupy movement in Portland where a young woman was yelling at the police, and a police officer, I believe it was a woman actually, sprayed pepper spray right into her mouth. Unbelievable, unreasonable, inexcusable. So this is the situation we're looking at. So we know historically the police were the instrument of power during union struggles, going way back to 1910, 1912. And we know that this pattern of establishmentarianism on the part of the police has always been a factor in union struggle, labor struggles of all kinds, in all kinds of civil rights struggles. In other words, the police are a force of reaction. Interestingly, after Ferguson, Missouri, we're beginning to see opportunistic, I think, Republicans, Ted Cruz, people like that, suddenly coming out and saying, gee, this militarization of the police is undemocratic. This militarization of the police, we libertarians don't like. Well, let's hope they mean it. Let's hope it's real. But I don't know. The Ferguson tensions were reduced by bringing in the head of the highway patrol, who was a large, handsome African-American man who could mingle with the crowds, came from the same neighborhoods, and could defuse the situation. He caused the police to stop wearing all the armor. He got rid of the snipers. He got rid of the armored personnel carriers. Things calmed down. I don't know what happened last night as of how late, but mainly there was a celebratory attitude and a hope that there will be a thorough investigation of the murder of this man. I want to emphasize, I really think it's important to understand, it's not like I'm saying this guy was murdered. There are three witnesses to Michael Brown's shooting. He was unarmed. He was running away. He was shot in the back. And when he turned around, he was with his hands up, he was shot again and again. This is murder. This is not what we'd hoped for. This is not what we'd thought the civil rights movement would bring about. The militarization of the police is part and parcel of the militarization of civil society that we're seeing everywhere. The racism that's attached with this is an inevitable consequence of the racism in our society. I want to hear from you. I want to know what your experiences are. I want to know what your insights are. And I want you to know what you think ought to be done. Remember, this is a long historical reality. When we talked in schools of officer friendly, we were essentially distorting the truth. Officer ain't so friendly. Let's hear from you, 231-8187. Who do we have? Bunny. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Good points there, Joe. Very, very good points. And I just wanted to say one thing real quickly. We went down to the vigil yesterday, and there was a woman speaking, and I thought her points were really good, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, black parents have to worry about their children all the time, just the way, not just the way, but, you know, parents in general have an awful lot to worry about these days. But in addition, black parents have to worry about this. It's pretty sickening. And the old slogan, to protect and to serve, is a really noble slogan. And there are many good officers that abide by that. They do. But you don't see it on the cars anymore. And the thing about it is, it's just, cowards terrorize, and they took the opportunity to terrorize an entire black community, 75% black population, sizable community, at once. It wasn't just like, oh, we're, you know, skulking down the alleyways or menacing or threatening the way coward terrorist-type people do. It's like, We're gonna blast you all at once now. You can see what we can do. They didn't do this to Santa Barbara. They might try it on Santa Barbara someday, but I reemphasize we do appreciate the good officers who certainly have their work cut out for them. And, I understand better that it truly, truly is significant right now. It is a bad thing, particularly hard on blacks. But if it isn't taken care of, it will be hard on everyone. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much for the call. I think there's really some important things to consider here. Portland joined the Joint Terrorism Task Force of the United States government following 9/11. There was some resistance, and finally Portland became a part of that. The Joint Terrorism Task Force functions very much like the NSA. It gathers data, it gathers names, it doesn't interview, it doesn't necessarily establish guilt, but it establishes lists of people to be watched. And it has a role in creating terror among civilians, as if people, native citizens of the United States, African Americans, persons of color, but anyone else as well, treating them as if they are agents of a foreign power bent on a terrorist destruction. It makes of the normal civilian population a population that can well be feared and reasonably be treated as if they are somehow dangerous. This is a very bad situation. It's getting worse. It's really out of control. Hopefully what happened in Missouri will turn around public opinion. To hear Senator Cruz, an opportunistic right-winger, to hear people like him suddenly saying, hey, wait a minute, this is not right, is hopeful. Now, yes, it's opportunistic. Yes, it's reactionary. But yes, it's also a good sign. So let's all think about that. And let's all talk about this again and again and again. Let's not let these events pass unnoticed in Portland or elsewhere. I want to hear from John, 231-8187. Hey, you're on the air.
Hi, Joe. I love what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for it. I don't have personal experience to share, but what do you think of why the American media never connects the dots to these separate incidents? Like, I've never once heard Andy Lopez brought up on NPR.
Mm.
And where I've heard about it is flashpoints and probably Democracy Now, but never once. And to me, it's just as big a story as should have been.
Mm-hmm.
So, you don't like conspiracy theories, but wouldn't you call it a conspiracy for them not to talk about Andy Lopez?
Well, first of all, you need to tell our audience who Andy Lopez is. It's important.
Well, he's a 13-year-old boy shot dead by a cop in, forget the town, in California.
Yes. Yes.
And he was playing with a toy gun, and the cop was a...
Oh, right. I remember this case now.
The cop was a trainer of other cops. he thoroughly knew that that was a toy gun. He had to have known, and he got away scot-free.
Yes, it's one of many examples. There have been other shootings, by the way, some in Portland in earlier times, yep, back in the late 50s, early 60s. Police have shot innocent people and gotten away with it. In fact, in the history of Portland's black community, there were numerous incidents dating from the 40s into the 50s and 60s, where the police ran things in the Albina neighborhood, essentially in cohesion and coherent involvement, even in terms of taking bribes and so on, and keeping control, keeping the lid on the black community. I can remember in 1963, I believe it was, the black Muslims were trying to sell their newspaper down around Myron Frank downtown, and they were removed. They were sent away. They were told to get out of the state. They were threatened. These are things that are part of our history. And they are really a serious, in every instance, another nail in the coffin of democracy. I have had good experiences with police in Portland. I've actually used police as informants and people who I can talk to about issues within the police department. I've developed a lot of contacts there. But I've also had, in my own life, experiences that were really quite terrifying. In 1967, in the Lair Hill neighborhood, 68, I was doing social work. And I thought I knew a policeman there, and they were hassling a bunch of motorcycle gangsters. And I waved down this one policeman, turned out to be this guy named Murphy, who did not like me. And he arrested me for carrying a concealed weapon, which was a regular pocket knife in a sheath that some kid had made me in the neighborhood. And I was thrown in the back of a police car. Now, in those days, the police didn't handcuff everybody. They do now, and I was in the back seat there, and I was mad, and I was saying that this was the doings of a member of the city council, and I was on and on and on, and really had lost it, but was not physical. And the police response was to stop the car abruptly, put on the brakes abruptly, slam me into the shield over and over again. And at one point, there was a leather box in the back, and it rolled open, and there on the floor was a pistol. I'm not making this up. So here I am, unhandcuffed, in the back seat of a police car, and suddenly there's a pistol rolling out, laying out on the floor of the back seat of the car. Suddenly I got quiet and really scared. This, to me, it was total paranoia. Am I being set up? What's going on here? Well, it turned out it was a flare pistol. But when the police got me to the downtown police precinct, the old Oak Street, 3rd and Oak Place, and they saw that, they got mad at me. And, they took me upstairs to jail. That was where the jail was then, and managed to miss the doorway with me every chance they got. So I was being slammed here, slammed there, whacked here, whacked there. And I was being treated relatively gently compared to some other folks, I'm pretty sure. But that experience, that initial arrest experience, reminded me and helped me to understand exactly what was going on. Now, I had been involved in civil disobedience in the past. I had been involved in organizing nonviolent activities for the Congress on Racial Equality and so on. I was not super prepared, but reasonably able to contain myself in the situation, though I did, as I say, lose it when I was arrested for no good reason. The case was later not dismissed, but continued indefinitely by a judge who's no longer around, who'd had no idea of the law at all here in Portland, Oregon. Eventually, we appealed that, and that was overturned. You can no longer be arrested and have your case continued indefinitely. You must have, as the Constitution requires, a fair and reasonably fast trial. Some small progress. But in that instance, which was a classic example of police abuse, I learned that nobody, even a nice white boy like me, is safe from the abuses of the police. And that was before the Joint Terrorism Task Force. That was before the up-armoring of the police department. Now, how did this up-armoring happen? Well, after the beginning of the Gulf War, second Gulf War, after the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, there was lots of equipment left over. And Homeland Security was giving it away or selling it at cost, or giving grants and then selling it to cities, so that every city, including Portland, now has up-armored vehicles, now has M16s, now has enormous amounts of weaponry. And when you give people heavy-duty weaponry, when you give people heavy-duty armored vehicles, the temptation to use them, to display them, to intimidate with them, is almost irresistible. That's really, really what had happened. A structural change in what was available to the police, a structural change in the attitude of the police, a change that has permanent, serious implications for justice, for freedom, for what old Superman used to say, the American way of life. I'd love to hear from more of you. This murder in Los Angeles, this murder in other places, these murders, particularly the most recent one in Missouri, in Ferguson, are characteristic of a police department that is racist on top of a police department that is hyper-militarized. I want to hear from you. 231-8187. Randy, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you for bringing some transparency to this troubling matter. I think we need to spend just a brief moment thinking about how we recruit law enforcement officers in our country, particularly in Portland. There's this enormous revolving door where one exits the military and dons a municipal police department uniform with increasing frequency. This is not an accident. This is part of the psychological profile that's sought by these publicly financed paramilitary gangs. And I hope you can reflect on my comments, true or false, in some meaningful way. Thank you.
I don't know that. I appreciate your call. I don't know the statistics of. I do know that it is to the advantage of an individual to have come out of the military, particularly the military police, and move into the police department. But I don't know how often that happens in Portland. I don't know what the percentage of new recruits are who come out of the military. I suspect it's high, but I don't know. More important, however, is the whole attitude of many, many police officers. Years ago, Rosie Sizer was the chief of police. She was the second woman to have that position. And actually, she and I developed a talking relationship. And then during one demonstration, we were walking along in the street talking with each other. And I said, gee, you know, it'd be really great if you could have a series of seminars inviting people like me to talk with officers on a different perspective. And she said, I don't know what that noise is. She said, hey, our police don't think in those terms. Our police don't have that kind of political sophistication. This was the chief of police talking about the officers that she had under her command. It was very telling, and it was very disappointing. And I don't think she was misstating what was happening. So part of what seems to go on, and I know of a guy actually who was an excellent candidate for police, but they rejected him because he wasn't aggressive enough. So there's a real pattern there. So we know that what the police department often is looking for is people who can take command, take control, not necessarily people who can identify with the problems of their subjects. And I think subject is the right term. This has to change. This militarization, structural militarization of the police, has to end. It's all over the United States, and it's outrageous. And it's really just an outward symbol of an inward rise of a late-stage capitalism and proto-fascism. Francis, you're on the air. Francis?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
The day that Rosie Sizer was fired, her hot squad, the ones that ran around looking for gang members, executed my son's friend Keaton Otis. That was May 12th, 2010. If you want personal experiences, we can go back since I first moved into Northeast Portland in 1970 when I married my husband. Mm-hmm. There have been, through each decade, many killings by the police department. Many. You can go to 1998. Remember when that man was killed in a botched drug raid and they were carrying his naked body around in the back of that truck?
I don't know about the naked body. I do remember the killing, and I think the excuse was that he had a lighter that they thought was a gun.
Right. Well, he was a white man. But that night, a young man named Aaron Rahman, who was, had alleged gang affiliations, was shot in the back on Albina and out Killingsworth by the police department. And in 2005, a 100-pound unarmed young lady named Kendra James was shot as she was trying to get away from the police and was left to bleed to death on the overpass on Skidmore over the freeway. And they said they thought she was faking when she said she was hurt. They knew she was shot.
Mm-hmm.
They just left her there because they didn't think she was hurt that bad.
And we had the chokehold killing.
That was Tony Lloyd Stevens.
Right.
You know, and when that happened,
a veteran, by the way.
Some of the police department members decided to make t-shirts that said, because there was a public outrage about that chokehold.
Mm-hmm.
Don't choke them, smoke them.
I remember that.
And I believe that since that is exactly what they've been doing.
And then there was the possum incident where a dead possum was left in front of a restaurant.
Yeah, there's been that forever. But the shooting of unarmed people and young people and young black men. My son, I've given that speech to my children.
You know, I want to stop for a minute because I want to make something clear to people. They may not know this. If you are an African American or Hispanic or a person of color, you give your children a speech which says essentially, be very careful, be polite to the police, don't give them any excuse to hurt you or kill you.
Exactly. Because my son, especially my oldest son, was very charismatic and very outspoken and very, you know, assertive,
mm-hmm.
and did not appreciate being disrespected.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to really, really talk with him about how he responds to officers, because
mm-hmm.
he knows his right. As do all my children, but they also know now to be very careful about how and when they assert their rights. It depends on the officer and how they are being treated.
Yeah, I want to make something clear here, because I don't want to brand every officer as a bad person, male or female. There are very good, very reasonable members of the police department. But the culture, the police culture, particularly in this process of militarization, is nasty and dangerous and disrespecting of minorities and poor people.
Exactly. And the issue is, though, that there are good officers, and I and my children have encountered them. However, if you're really a good officer, how can you continue on a force where you know these things are happening and you just look the other way and pretend like you don't know what's going on?
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question.
To be a good officer. Because this should not be happening now. This is 2014. My young son, when he was a kid, when he was a little boy, he used to get stickers, his little sheriff stickers from the police officers when they drove through the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden he started looking like a man, like a young man. And he did it at a fairly young age. And then for the next 3 years, I think he was stopped an average of 5 times in his own neighborhood within a 5-block radius just to see who he was and what he was doing. And, you know, we were looking for somebody that you kind of fit the description.
Yeah, being black or whatever.
That's wrong. And that is wrong to do that.
Right.
To young people. Psychologically, that is wrong. And I fault our city for allowing it to continue. I fault the city, I fault the mayor, I fault Vera Katz, I fault whoever has been there who pretends like they don't know what's going on, because they do.
Well, I have
to... At this point, I'm going to stop talking because I'm feeling myself getting angry.
Yes.
So I'll talk to you later.
Okay, I appreciate the call. You know, the name Vera Katz came up because the mayor who actually, who I spent an hour with talking about what really happened in 99, was Vera Katz. And I thought maybe that would have some impact. I'm not an important person. I guess I didn't have any impact. But in the room with us was Sam Adams, interestingly enough, who was then her exec. Okay, we got more calls, 231-8187. I want to be clear. We're talking about two different things, but they're interactive. They're interconnected. The first is the absolute disrespecting and murderous intent of the police toward persons of color in the United States. The second is the militarization of the police under Joint Terrorism Task Force, earlier under LEA, various agencies, and the giving away or selling cheaply or granting people, the police departments, weapons of war as if they were essentially occupying the cities of the United States. 231-8187, who do we have? Ted, you're on the air.
Hi, Joe. Am I on?
Yeah, you are.
Okay. I'm calling because I'm very concerned about the vicious attack dog squads that are run by the Portland police.
Wait a minute. Tell me about this.
Well, there was a recent incident in my neighborhood where one such dog was shot and killed, and an officer was wounded in the ricochet. So you can imagine.
Well, now you're talking about doggies, four-legged animals.
I call them vicious attack dogs.
Okay.
You know, but there was a big media thing about it on TV and so on, where they present them as cute little puppies, but they're really trained to bite people. And
well,
in
L.A., they used to have a rule that if the dog was sicked on you, the dog got to bite you at least once. Anyway,
well,
go ahead.
I don't know what the Portland rule is.
I have no idea. But anyway.
I don't like them, and I don't know what their mission is here in Portland. Why do we have them, and what is their mission? But I wanted to get out something that's disturbing me, which is there's a movement to build a statue in our neighborhood to get funding for the cute little doggy that was killed and put a statue up. I find it distressing, and I want people to know about it and do what they can.
What neighborhood is this?
It's Multnomah.
Okay.
Neighborhood in Southwest.
Uh-huh.
So our neighborhood association, I'm sort of active there, and it's just almost impossible to speak in the group. It's presented as this cute little doggy was killed, and you know, and then I try to stand up and say, but wait a minute, you know, and there's just, it's just a very bad feeling.
Well, I think a lot of people in America, and in Portland particularly, which is a very prideful city, there is a real misunderstanding of what's happening in police world. The militarization of the police includes, of course, police dogs. The militarization of police includes deadly weapons far more powerful than the police have ever used or needed in the past. The militarization includes up-armored vehicles, as if we had roadside bombs and shooting at police, which we do not have. All of this is part of a trend nationally to create a vast and repressive at-home virtual army. And I think it's a terrible thing, and I think it's very dangerous, and I think a lot of people are very naive about it because they're frightened. We have a lot of fear in America about crime, even though the statistics don't bear out the reasoning of the fear.
Well, I completely agree with you, Joe. I'm very concerned about it. Let me just mention that aside from the statue, which is in the works somewhere, I'm not sure where, Multnomah is going to have its crazy days this weekend, and the officers involved in the squad are going to be honored and paraded down with the grand marshal of the parade and everything. It would be great if there were a few boos in the crowd.
I don't know about the boos, but I think it's kind of weird. I think what's happening is we're all being propagandized and sold a bill of goods about a hyper-militarized police force in every city in the United States, including Portland. And again, when I say this, I always immediately want to say, look, when we generalize about the police, we're talking about the politics of policing. We're talking about the equipment of policing. We're talking about the behavior generally of policing. We're not talking about specific officers, and we need to make a distinction there. I don't want to create some kind of hate campaign against individual officers. But I agree with you. Glorifying attack dogs, glorifying the weaponry, glorifying the police without any critical essay of who they are and what they're doing is stupid. And it's really unwarranted. And it expresses a kind of bourgeois naivete about the police.
Yes, it does. And my booze would be for the squad. And I just more generally like to know what the rules are for deployment. You know, what is this squad of vicious dogs for? And
well,
when
I always,
are they allowed to be deployed?
The original function of those animals, as I was told, and that doesn't mean it's true, was about drugs and that they could sniff out drugs. The other part of that is they could also find people who had gone to ground and were hiding. But the fact of the matter is a dog or a horse or another animal has no conscience, has no awareness at a human level, does what it's told, and really is could easily be out of control. And this is a real reasonable fear. By the way, the use of dogs is very popular in minority neighborhoods, use of dogs by the police, because historically they have been used to repress people of color.
Well, just about the incident that occurred in the neighborhood, it was a pullover. They stopped three guys who had robbed a store nearby. There was no question of finding them. They were sitting in the car,
yeah.
And they deployed the dog, and the guy shot the dog, and a ricochet hit an officer in the leg. So I don't know. I find it disgusting. That doesn't sound like the scenario that you described. And I like to put some restrictions on, you know, if it's a search and rescue or something, but I don't think they're really trained for that.
No.
But I'd like to know more about the vicious attack dog squad.
Okay.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for the call. 231-8187 is the number to call. We're talking about two interrelated but separate topics. One is the murderous quality of the police toward minority people. We saw it in New York, where a large man was chokeholded to death because he was selling individual cigarettes, allegedly. We see it in Los Angeles. We see it in the Central Valley of California. We see it now most recently in the outright murder in Ferguson, Missouri, of an 18-year-old who the next day was going to be going to college. This is the kind of thing we are seeing. And then we see the response of the police when the neighborhood gets outraged, introducing powerful weapons, introducing up-armored vehicles, putting on the roofs of them police with sniper rifles, aiming at the demonstrating crowds. Fortunately, the intercession did take place in Missouri, and things have calmed down, and the police are behaving in a more reasonable manner under better leadership. But the whole thing was absolutely inexcusable. 231-8187. The other part of all of this, by the way, is the fact that the police have been militarized and that they look for people who are authoritarian, as opposed to authoritative, to be police officers. I want to hear from you. 231-8187. Bruce.
Good morning. I wonder if you could say something about the strength of the police union, the Portland Police Association, and also the so far fairly ineffective intervention of the Justice Department, so far fairly ineffective in changing police behavior. It seems that the Portland police are regarded as a more or less autonomous body, have very far the strongest voice in the contract negotiations with the city council, and this situation of this sort of independent police body within the city of Portland seems to be accepted more or less at will by the council and by the people at large. So,
yeah, I will talk about that a little bit because it's important. I want to make a distinction between paying the police a decent wage in a job that is very difficult. That's on the one hand. I also want to toss out a little funny history for you. Back in the day when the police were trying to get organized, they weren't allowed to go on strike. Ever since a Boston police strike back in the 1920s, I think it was, the police nationally have essentially in every state have laws against their going on strike. So they have a limited ability to force the issue. Now, in Portland, the police were trying to organize a union and got nowhere. The Longshoremen's Union went to the police and said, hey, you know, if you put up a picket, a symbolic picket at the various docks and so on, longshoremen will not cross those picket lines. And that will put enormous pressure on the city. That was done, and the result was that the police got their union. Now, people don't remember that. People don't even remember that the Longshoremen's Union was a left-wing union, often red-baited during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. The fact of the matter is that the Portland police are unionized because the Longshoremen's Union made it possible for it to happen. And I think that's an important story. And I think it's important to understand that. And I think it's important to understand where there's a cleavage between the concerns of working people organizing for their own interests and the interests of their members, and the proper behavior of police and other agencies. The Portland Association of Police, well, I can't remember their official union name, is such a union, and it does seem to be able to limit the powers of the city council in discussions of police issues. On top of that, we have the decision of the city council to become part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, initially resisted, which is a, from my point of view, total bull thing to create fear and legitimize terroristic use of force by law enforcement against civilian communities with the pretense that somehow there's a potential for civil disturbance on an enormous scale. I want to hear from you, 231-8187. Sheila, you're on the air.
Yeah. Well, I want to bring up something I think is a lot more ominous about this arming militarization of the police. I don't think it's an accident. I think it's very deliberate. I think it's very deliberate by our government in general. We have a country now that is being reduced to poverty. The middle class is disappearing. There are more people living in poverty than ever before. People becoming very, I think at some point people are going to become desperate. And they go, and we may end up at some point with people really, I'm reluctant to use the word revolution, but we could have a lot of people really starting to get angry and acting out, and maybe it would be a revolution. And what better thing than to have a militarized police to put this down, like in other countries where people say enough is enough. So I think that the police are being militarized for a reason.
So you see it as essentially a conspiratorial effort by the powers that be to control things.
I hate to use the word conspiracy. I don't want to go to that place, but I think it's a deliberate thing. We have Blackwater encampments all over the country. What the hell are they there for? You know, I think we're in a very, very dangerous time right now.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I think that there is a real contradiction between the idea of community policing, which was much touted a few years ago, and the behavior of law enforcement these days, and in fact, the up-armoring and the creation of essentially a riot squad, which is what they used to be called, who are wearing armor, who are people you cannot talk to, you cannot reason with. Once they are in those modes, once they're in those uniforms, once they're under discipline, once they're wearing their shields and so on, there's no conversation. There's no possibility.
How intimidating is that to people who would like to protest? Now, people are not even, I mean, we have our free speech is being restricted.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get out there and say certain things without being clamped down upon.
Yeah, and I think it's particularly harsh and particularly onerous on minority communities. And
right.
So I draw the two issues into one really larger issue of policing in the United States.
And I think it's very frightening.
Yeah, it's scary. It's scary.
Very frightening. And I don't see why we don't get to that. People are really look what's happening to the people in this country that can't afford to live anymore, that are being thrown out of their homes. I mean, there has to be a lot of seething anger. And where is this anger going right now?
Yeah, I take your point. I think you're making a very good point. I think one of the interesting things that happens in Portland is we have a lot of homeless people. We have a lot of homeless youth. And they're annoying. You know, beggars are annoying. People sitting on the sidewalk, annoying. People defecating in inappropriate places, annoying. So we tend to be a society with a real bifurcation. Even if we don't want to see harsh policing, we don't want to see people who are unemployed and who are, dangerous in perception out there. We don't want the kids in black downtown. The merchants don't want them. The shoppers don't want them. So we really are creating classes of people who are other. And it extends beyond the common minorities, persons of color, into groups like the wandering young people who we see in Portland and other cities. No employment, no education, no skills.
And no jobs.
And no jobs, right.
And what is the government is not doing anything. We get lip service, but we don't get action.
I agree with you, and I thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Okay, well, we're talking now, if you're just tuning in, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. I'm Joe Uris. I'm sitting in for the two excellent women who do this show regularly, Positively Revolting, which is focused on kind of primarily on feminist issues, but this is a broader issue than that, I think. And we do have callers, 231-8187. Gary, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd just like to bring to your attention, you know, if you go to the colleges now that teach police training and such, mm-hmm. they are taught right off the bat to not trust anybody. You don't have no friends. You don't have no family. We are your family.
Wow.
This is what they're being taught nowadays, all right?
Is that true?
This is very true. And we have a lot of good police officers out there, an awful lot of them. But, however, there's, like in my industry, I'm a truck driver. I've been in it 40 years, and I've watched, over the years, the scale houses go from unarmed people working there, wearing a badge, trying to do a job, to becoming more like Gestapo officers, blouse boots, dark, you know, pants, dark shirt with a big 45 on their side. You know, I mean, we got to have a happy medium somewhere, because with these gangs and the drug dealers and what have you, if we don't have law enforcement, it's going to be a free-for-all. So where do we draw the line? Mm-hmm. But we can't have these officers just going out and shooting just because they feel threatened. No, you got to have something else there. You know, when I was being trained, I was taught if they bring a stick, you bring, you know, a gun. You know, you got to be able to protect yourself. And when you shoot to kill, because a dead man can't talk. And that's the way the officers are trained. And it's sad that, you know, our society has gotten to the point to where we have different things going on in life, you know, and one color doesn't respect the other color. And I grew up back in the 50s and the 60s in Washington, D.C., right in the Capitol. And I was only living five blocks away, and that was considered the ghetto then. And I remember one officer, him and his dog, were both shot to death by a sniper.
Mm.
And that whole community got together. They were very upset about that officer and that dog being killed. So I'd like to see the old days come back where we did have police officers walking the beat, not just patrolling. I'd like to see where we can communicate once again. But the way society has gotten, we brought it on ourselves. That's the main thing I could say.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the call and for your insights on all of this. It is certainly the case that the approachability of the police officer, the notion of the cop on the beat, the maybe two-man personal patrol or two-women personal patrol, walking the streets and getting to know the community, getting to know the kids in the community, getting to understand the politics and power of the relationships in that community, is disappearing. Everybody feels that the police are an occupying army. The police themselves feel like an occupying army rather than a friendly force to keep law and order. I want to hear from other people. 231-8187. We're talking about two things simultaneously. We're talking about the murderous quality of police behavior toward minorities, and we're talking about the militarization of the police. Chris, you're on the air.
Joe, I really appreciate your show today.
Thank you.
One thing that really bothers me that nobody seems to talk about is the Defense of America Act, where Obama made a signing statement that he wasn't going to enact it while he's president.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's gone, which is a couple of years, it's up to anybody to enact what he signed he wasn't going to do. And all this talk we're doing now is really good, but then when he leaves, that law goes into effect, and all this talk will be rhetoric because the president has the ability to go and have the army pick anybody up and take them off the street and put them in jail forever like Guantanamo. So that's what I'm concerned about, Joe.
Okay.
I'm surprised nobody's talking about it.
Well, it's an interesting point, and I think there is not. I used to think, well, that's paranoid, you know, but things have gotten very, very strange, and I definitely see a pattern here in which policing agencies and the military and many intelligence agencies are essentially functioning as an occupier of the American landscape, occupier of America.
Well, I'm glad you think so, too, because I sure feel that way about it. And I'm going to let you go, and thanks a lot for your show today.
Well, thank you. All right, you take care now. All right, 231-8187. Do we have time for another call? Okay, I think we're done. I want to thank you all for tuning in. This is a major issue, these two things together. The treatment of minority, particularly minority youths, but minority people in general, by the occupying armies of a militarized police force in every city, in every county, in every state in the United States. All of this has to be resisted, has to be criticized, has to be attacked for what it is, which is really a defeat of civil liberties and civil rights in the United States. Thank you all very much. You stay tuned. KBOO brings you the truth, and it will do it over and over again as long as you help us keep on the air.
This is a man's world, but it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. You see, man made the car to take us over.
KALU Community Radio and Triangle Productions are proud to co-sponsor the return of Medicarefully Fabulous. Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th, Medicarefully Fabulous will return to the Sanctuary Theater for a limited engagement. The show is a series of original stories about aging, faith, friendships, and recovery. Again, that's Medicarefully Fabulous, Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at KALU.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Registration is now open for the Pacific Northwest Social Forum coming.